With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MACK25. With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.
Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. WalkingPost.com is the news website dedicated to walking, with all the latest on events, trails, gear, science, festivals, and more. And you'll want to listen to the podcast today because it's filled with great information. The downside is you have to listen to me. But today we're talking about Japanese walking in an in-depth interview that also includes the three most important things about your walking shoes, and I can tell you right now, mine failed, busting a myth, and loads more. And that's with Dr. Melissa McDowell of Gait Happens. And we're also talking about why Brighton and Hove was voted the most walkable city in the UK, with the city's walking officer, Delphine Jacques. This podcast number 17 is going out on June the 27th, last day of school for the year in Scotland, so I've got about half an hour before the YouTube marathon starts. Let's move on to those weird and wonderful special days for June the 27th. It's Multiculturalism Day. It's also Pineapple Day, and it is Sunglasses Day, which isn't very much use here. PTSD Awareness Day, and it's also Onion Day. So I'd better put some on my pizza tonight then. No pineapple though. Seriously, people do that? Cue all of the email messages saying, I put pineapple on my pizza. The weather in the UK has been pretty warm even here in Scotland, and that's supposed to continue. I don't know what the weekend will hold. My son went on a school trip on Thursday, and it was a very long day, so he might still be playing the tired card. I had to get him to school for 6 a.m. in the pouring rain. Fun stuff. I remember my first long school trip was to Paris when I was 13, same age as he is now. And I still remember vividly the woman at the register at the Eiffel Tower not giving me my change when we all bought tickets. And I argued with her in French and told her I wasn't moving until she gave me my change. She waited about 5 minutes before realising that I was serious and that there was a very annoyed line getting longer behind me. Funnily enough, I didn't tell her exactly what amount I'd given her, but when she threw the change at me, it was correct. And wow, did she ever hurl it. She would have made a good baseball pitcher. Anyway, as always, I digress. Let's move on to the podcast. Last time we had two interviews from the outdoor show in Liverpool, and we will be having some more interviews with companies that were in attendance over the next few weeks, of course alongside many other subjects. Last time we talked to the Milford Collection about wristbands to keep away bugs, and Manaslu about some trendy, warm, and frankly very cool Nepalese jumpers. This week we're going to Brighton, although not literally, and Japan, kind of. Stay tuned. But of course, first we take a look at some of the week's articles on walkingpost.com. It was a very busy week again on the news front, which is good when you run a news site. If you do have news, guest ideas or comments, please do get in touch via walkingpost.com, or you can just email me at jim@walkingpost.com. So it's time for our short-ish recap of some of the headlines of the news articles we had on walkingpost.com this past week. RAB has partnered with the Polar Academy. In Maine, the Double the Dirt campaign is helping trail users. And shoe manufacturer Xtep previewed its 2026 first quarter products. There are new options available for illumination in the dark, and there has been a boost to walking routes in Suffolk. A new book from the Netherlands celebrates women walking pioneers. It looks like a great book, but sadly, for now at least, it's only in Dutch. Hopefully an English version very soon. Swedish clothing company Haglöfs celebrated its new core range of outdoor pants, also known as trousers, and the Appalachian Trail Conservancy launched a $50 million anniversary fundraising campaign. A new walking and cycling route has opened between Enfield Town and Broxbourne. The final section of a walking route in Wales is being constructed, and in the US, the Wilderness Society says a US bill is proposing 255 million acres of public land for sale to developers. You can read all of these and many more at walkingpost.com. Two great interviews for you this week, and the first of them, if you're a reader of the news at walkingpost.com, and why wouldn't you be, relates to an article we had a few weeks ago now that announced Brighton and Hove in East Sussex was named the most walkable city in the UK and the third most walkable in the world by the magazine Time Out. Having spent a couple of years in Sussex, not that far from Brighton, I can agree it's a great place. It really has everything you need and something a lot of cities don't have, and that's the sea. And on the other side, it has the South Downs. I was curious to find out why the city did so well, so I asked. To tell us all about Brighton and the things it's doing for walkers is walking officer at the Brighton and Hove Council, Delphine Jacques.
Well, I guess the first question then is if you could tell me a bit about the reasons why you think Brighton may have been named the top walkable city in the UK.
Yeah, well, I think there's an obvious one, which is the natural environment, really. You know, we're really blessed in Brighton and Hove. We have on one side the sea and on the other side the downs. So there's plenty of opportunities to be in nature. And the seafront, for example, stretches for about 13 kilometers within the city. And so you have the seafront and then you have undercliff paths, lots of, you know, off-road walking, which is really very accessible as well, very flat. And then on the other side, you have the downs, which are obviously quite hilly, but there's loads of paths and just beautiful places to go to and a variety of places as well. And in the city itself, we have loads of green spaces as well. We have over 150 parks and green spaces available for the public. So you're never really very far away from a green space as well. That's one thing. But I think the other thing as well is that there's been loads of investment in the city in terms of trying to create those places for people, accessible, safer places for people to hang out and to walk and cycle as well. That makes a big difference because we know if the infrastructure is there, people are more likely to use them. The other thing as well, in terms of car ownership, about a third of people in the city don't own a car or don't have access to a car. So perhaps there is this culture already of, you know, using other forms of transport, busing and cycling and obviously walking. And Brighton Hove is quite a compact city as well. It's not a huge place. It's quite easy to walk from one place to another.
You mentioned the infrastructure and the spending that's happened in and around Brighton. What are some of the initiatives that Brighton has implemented to improve walkability and reduce the footprint and improve getting around without cars?
There's been loads, and I'm not going to talk about them, all of them, but I can talk about the more recent schemes. So one that's had a big impact really in the city centre is a scheme called Valley Gardens. So it's right in the centre, and it's really a gateway, one of the main gateways to get into the city, and used to be very car dominated. There was a space for people, but it was very underused and not very well maintained. It wasn't a place where really you wanted to hang out. But we managed to get some funding to improve that space, and it's made a huge difference. It's now a space where the traffic has changed, so it's still busy, but there is a big sort of space in the middle for people with much better cycle lanes and also a lot more sort of nature. It's a place where you want to be. And the Valley Garden 3, the last phase, is now going to take those improvements all the way to the seafront, to the Palace Pier area, and it's just going to finish off that scheme, really. But there's quite a lot of sort of similar schemes that have happened or are going to happen very soon. And again, with the same idea to really rebalance, I suppose, the space between cars, vehicles and cyclists and walking and try to make active travel a viable option, really, and a more pleasant and safer experience. But there's not just that. I think there's other things as well. Like recently, we've been allowed to put red routes in. So it's basically, instead of having double yellow lines, you have red lines. I think you see them quite a lot in London. And there is no stopping at all allowed for any vehicles. And again, that makes quite a big difference because it means that there is better flow of traffic. So it's, you know, it can be safer for pedestrians and also less obstructions. But it's also creating destinations for people to walk to. And there's been, again, a lot of investment on the seafront to revive certain areas of the seafront that were very underused. So I wanted to mention a new park, which is called Hove Beach Park in the west of the city. Basically, they've completely turned an area of underused land, really, into a place for sports and activities. As part of this development, there's going to be a new cycle lane and improved, you know, crossing points and better, you know, pavements and things like that. A redesign, really, of the whole area, which is a place where people are going to come to. As a council, we're consulting on a new city transport plan, which is going to take us all the way to 2035. In this transport plan, there's a big emphasis on active travel infrastructure and offering walking and cycling as a really viable options to go around the city. So that's something that's out for consultation in within the public space at the moment. So it's a big piece of work.
How easy is it to get around Brighton? Because obviously there's public transport and you mentioned it's close to the Downs.
It's an interesting question because I would say it is easy and sometimes not, because on the one hand, it is easy because we've got a really good bus network that goes to most corners of the city, and we've improved cycle lanes and, you know, walking infrastructure in general. But because we are stuck between the sea and the Downs, it can be a very congested city as well. We have a huge tourism industry as well, so we have a lot of visitors. It can get very busy.
I know that when I've been hiking in the Downs, you sometimes see a Brighton bus going quite further out than you would expect.
Yeah, that's definitely, yes. So we have specific services that takes you to a few places in the Downs. Yeah, they're great because, again, it helps to either carry people who don't have access to a car or be a really viable alternative to driving to those places. And it's not just those particular buses, actually. A lot of normal routes within the city will go past a point of nature near the Downs. So actually, one of the projects I'm going to be working on is promoting those bus routes and providing a map to show where people can get off and access a path. Because I think there is this perception that if you don't have a car, you can't access those places. And actually, in many cases, you can. As part of this project, we will be promoting certain walks on the Downs in the city. And I will be also developing a leaflet. There's going to be printed versions of the leaflet that will be accessible in libraries and community centres. But it will be online as well.
And I guess there's trains as well that can take you out into the Downs or even, you know, Kent, Dorset.
Yes, and we have a really good, and even within the city, trains are really well used as well, because we still have quite a lot of small stations that serve different points in the city. And, you know, it's well used for commuters and students. So we have a good combination. We also have a bike hire scheme, which is managed by the council, called Beryl's Bike. And they now have a fleet of e-bikes as well. They're very popular and very helpful, because Brighton is very hilly as well. So that can be a barrier to walking and cycling.
Yeah, you mentioned the map that you're going to be doing to help people get out and walk. Are there any other programs that have been making a difference in getting people out, whether it's walking, cycling?
I can talk about cycling as well, but I think I'll start with walking, because I'm the walking officer. I have been working on a scheme in the last few years, really, to try and support local groups to encourage walking within their communities. So I give out small grants, about £500, to set up and evaluate a walking scheme. It's been really interesting, because I've been approached by lots of different organisations. There's so much going on in Brighton. And it's been really interesting to see how walking can help beyond the transport side of things, help those groups. A lot of them face barriers to walking for different reasons. And it's really about creating a project that people can engage with and participate and get something out of it. And to give you some examples, I've been working with charities that support people with adults with learning disabilities, the trans community as well, even NHS mental health services. And what they have in common is the need really for a walking group that suits their needs and is going to make them feel safe and looked after and going to give them the opportunity to go back out in the community and start building that confidence, really, and that independence, that they can actually be out there and feeling the benefits as well, you know, the physical and mental health benefits of moving your body.
Yeah, that's something I was going to mention, the health benefits. I mean, that's clearly important as well.
Oh, it's massive. It's quite mind-blowing, to be honest. When I first started this job and I started looking at the statistics and evidence, there's actually an overwhelming amount of evidence that moving more, so that's including walking, is essential for health and well-being. And that comes from, you know, medical experts who have looked into data and have realized that doing your recommended physical activity, which is about 150 minutes a week, so it's about 30 minutes, 5 days a week of moderate exercise, so that's feeling a little bit out of breath, will have a massive impact on your health now, but in the future as well, in terms of preventing diseases. That's the sort of thing that I try to share in my work. And just to give you, you know, a few numbers in terms of impact, health impact, if you do those 150 minutes of physical activity a week, you will lower your risk of developing dementia, depression by 30%, certain types of cancers as well, like colon or breast cancer, between 20 and 30%, hip fracture up to 68%. And also those diseases that we know are real, are killers, the main killers of cardiovascular diseases, for example, by up to 40%. So they're big numbers. You know, we are in a crisis at the moment in terms of public health, and sedentary life is a huge issue. It's responsible for 1 out of 6 deaths in the UK, the fact of being inactive. And it's about the same as smoking. And we know there's lots done around helping people to quit smoking, and perhaps there should be even more done to help people be active again.
Are there any resources that there are out there to try and get people more active and walking more?
I work closely with the public health team in Brighton and Hove. They do a lot of work to try and help people, especially people who are, you know, inactive for lots of different reasons, to be a little bit more active. So there's a brilliant team, the Healthy Lifestyle team at the council, providing a whole program of activities and doing lots of outreach work to engage with lots of different communities and age groups. They have recently published their new vehicle strategy, and it's actually called Let's Get Moving. So it's recognizing that it's not just about sports, but it's about moving more in your daily life, incorporating more movement in your daily life. And that could be lots of different things. including trying to travel a little bit more actively. But if anybody is interested, they can have a look at the webpage, all about walking, brighton-hove.co.uk/walking. And there you can find information about local groups that you can join in the city, low cost or free groups. More information about the health benefits of walking. I think there is a link to a report that is really interesting, and other things as well that we do, you know, that we do around walking.
I know you mentioned the walking groups. There used to be a walking festival, I think, in Brighton as well.
Yeah, 2 or 3 years ago, I organised the first walking festival in Brighton. It was almost overdue, really, because when I started researching walking festivals, I realised that loads of other cities in the UK had already done one, and some of them were regular events. Mine, unfortunately, is not a regular thing. Again, it was really interesting to gauge people's appetite for walking, and there is a real appetite for it. You know, most people can walk, you know, enjoy walking. It's easy and free and simple. So it was not just an opportunity to get people walking and going on various walks and discover new places to walk in Brighton and Hove, but really trying to raise the profile of walking with all its benefits.
In your position, are there any other things that you're looking to be able to introduce?
There's loads of things that I'd like to do. We, at the moment, are, I suppose, a bit limited with budget, but we've just heard that we should be receiving a 3-year funding programme for next year, so that's very good news. I think I would like to carry on the work that I do with community grants and carry on evaluating them and gathering evidence to make more a case for walking. And who knows, maybe another walking festival.
What are your favourite places in and around Brighton for walks?
I think I would have to say that it's the Undercliff Path from the marina towards the east, really. It's just a beautiful place, white chalks, an off-road space for cyclists and walkers. And there's a great coffee shop as well, halfway to stop to for a cup of tea and an ice cream. But also, you know, the downs and just being in nature and, you know, being able to escape the busy city centre and finding yourself in those places of beauty. That's, you can't really beat that.
It's a great place, Brighton. The Pavilion is unique. The seafront's perfect for walking and it's right next to the South Downs, which everyone should experience if they can. Moving on, a few weeks ago, I started to see a term in my news feed quite a lot, and it was something I'd not seen before. And it is called Japanese walking, and I was curious. Did it mean I have to take a flight to Tokyo, where I once had a pretty horrific plane landing around 25 years ago? Or does it mean that I have to walk in the Japanese baseball shirt that I have? Turns out, neither, but I won't explain what it is, I'll leave that to the expert. And we do have an expert, because not only can she tell us about Japanese walking, as you'll find out, she knows her stuff about everything walking. I learned a lot, and I hope you will too, in this in-depth conversation with Melissa McDowell from the company Gait Happens. So, yeah, before we actually get to trends, I wonder if you could give me a bit of background on what you do and Gait Happens.
So good morning. My name is Dr. Melissa McDowell. I'm a physiotherapist based in the United States. Gait Happens is an education and product company. We provide courses and products for consumers as well as education for medical and health providers globally. The company was started about 10 years ago by Dr. Courtney Conley. She added a partner, Dr. Jen Perez, soon thereafter. They're both passionate chiropractors who are totally obsessed with feet and gait mechanics and teaching people how to optimize their total health by optimizing their foot health. The company's based in Colorado. We have several virtual practitioners who work on the team that are able to do one-on-one consults for clients across the globe. We teach live courses and we also teach digital courses. And so it's a really fun company. I'm the vice president of operations, and our mission is really to educate people about how to keep their feet healthy, how to optimize their walking mechanics, and how that leads to wellness and longevity.
Is that something a lot of people ignore?
It is. I think we, as a clinician, especially for me, we run into people who are very surprised that their feet could be contributing to back pain or their neck pain or their shoulder pain even. I think a lot of times medical systems compartmentalize the body parts that we take care of. You go to the ankle specialist versus the knee specialist versus the back specialist. And that compartmentalization of how healthcare providers are trained to look at the body sometimes means that if you have back pain and your doctor isn't interested in the foot or hasn't looked at your feet, they aren't making that connection. So I think it is something that oftentimes when we see patients or we're working with clients and consults, they're very surprised how big of a role your foot health plays in your total body health.
I guess we shouldn't really be surprised that social media is right at the forefront of every single trend and there's a new one every week. But Japanese walking is the latest one. And it's one of those that they give it credence by saying it was developed by researchers in Japan. I wonder if you could first kind of fill me in as to what it is.
So this emerged about 15 years ago, actually. The first research studies were around 2009, 2010. And that is one of the challenges of being a scientist, is you work on this phenomenal project, you find these important results, and then the information goes nowhere. And so we're always excited when something comes back around. And I do think that social media has an incredible power to provide information, get people excited, and just share things that really can make positive impacts on people's lives. We all know there's a dark side to it, but I think if you take it with the lens of, I'm seeing this information, I want to vet the information and see if it works for me, talking about it with your healthcare team or your experts, it can be a really great source of health information. So you are correct. Japanese walking has been around for 15 years-ish. We use the term interval walking training. And so an interchangeable term is IWT. And with that, it's a type of walking where you alternate fast, slow, fast, slow, fast, slow. There's some variation in how long those intervals are. Oftentimes you'll see people doing about 3 minutes of fast, 3 minutes of slow. And so it's not new. It's new in its popularity, but it has been around for a while. And there actually is a lot of data that supports it as a health intervention.
All right. And is it a good form of exercise?
I personally think any form of exercise is a good form of exercise. Yeah. You know, levels of sitting during professional work are at an all-time high. Since the pandemic, the number of steps people take per day has not really recovered because of working from home and other reasons. And so I just believe if we can get anything that'll get people moving, I'm a huge advocate for. I do think that in this sense, the interval walking training or Japanese walking is fairly safe. The risks are pretty low for most individuals. So if you were to compare Japanese walking to pickleball, for example, pickleball has been sweeping the globe. It's so popular. It's had this incredible rise to popularity recently. People love to participate because it's, you know, it's competitive and it's sort of a little bit like short duration. So you don't have to go spend a couple hours doing it. But the injury risks are crazy. We see Achilles tendon tears and ankle sprains and wrist fractures and all kinds of things from people who haven't done those explosive plyometric movements in many years or maybe ever. And they're out, you know, having a great social time with their friends, but participating in a sport that is very demanding. Walking, on the other hand, for most people is incredibly safe. And I do think that one of the great benefits of Japanese walking is it does alternate the intensity. Fast, slow. So you really can customize the exercise to meet you where you're at when you start participating.
Do you think there's a danger that people are always looking for, or maybe some, looking for the easiest way out?
Absolutely. We humans are creatures of ease, right? And I think that we have to acknowledge that, right? As a healthcare provider, for me, I understand the people that I see they're busy. They're looking to be efficient. They want to see quick results. And some of that is just our human nature, right? We want that dopamine burst because we've just succeeded in some way. And I think that when we're looking at exercise and physical activity participation, I like to tell everybody we're playing the long game here. And so it's really finding things that you can stick with, you can continue to feel motivated about, you can perhaps encourage others to participate, you can become an advocate of this type of movement. And so, you know, none of these things are really a quick fix. And I think that as adults, we have to recognize that that's a truth. The same with weight loss. You know, if you're trying to lose 20 pounds, that's not going to happen in a week or 2 weeks. That's a longer journey. You have to be very mindful about it. You have to be very prescriptive about what you're trying to do. And so I think that example is very similar to when you're participating in an activity program like this. You're not going to have a quick fix. Now, there are some things you are going to see change very rapidly. Mood, sleep, your mental clarity, those can all be impacted very quickly by starting a walking program. And so I think there are some ways that we can really hold on to the parts that change quickly and then honor the parts that are going to take a while to get going.
Are there any effects on the body? Obviously, it's better for you if you're active, but are there any issues with this kind of walking?
One of the challenges is if someone isn't used to varying their pace and trying to figure out what will be consistent for them during the Japanese walking protocol. So the protocols are typically 3 minutes slow, 3 minutes fast, 3 minutes slow, 3 minutes fast, and you alternate that for a period of time. The challenge is if you're not used to changing your pace, it can be a little bit difficult to try to hit those fast intervals so they're consistent rep over rep. There are some strategies to improve that. These types of devices are amazing. An iPhone can be really helpful. A metronome app is a really great way for people that are new to Japanese walking to figure out how fast to walk and how slow to walk. So if you're not familiar with what a metronome is, it's actually a tool that's used by musicians that helps them keep pace. Metronome apps are free online, and you can use it with an iPhone or even an Android device. And what it does is it gives you a consistent beep. So it goes beep, 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 beep on whatever pace you tell it to. A typical walking cadence that's brisk is about 100 beats per minute. And so if you want to work on understanding slow versus fast, you could use that as a training tool. So you could set your slow pace maybe at 85 or 90, set your fast pace at 100 or 110, and what'll happen is it'll help you feel that difference in the slow versus fast interval. In my experience, I think that's one of the things that individuals struggle with the most is trying to figure out how fast to go. They obviously don't want to go too fast to get out of breath, and they also don't want to walk too slow to get benefits. We also like to say we want you to fail the talk test. And if you're failing the talk test, it means you can't converse easily like we're talking right now. You would have to take different breaths in between, and you're walking and working hard enough that you can't just converse without using a little bit of that sort of breath sequencing. That generally means that you are brisk or more. And so what we want to do is you want to just be right below that level where you might have to catch your breath occasionally, but you're not out of breath and you can still carry on a conversation.
30 minutes seems to be mentioned as a duration. Is it dangerous or not useful to go longer than that? Or can you go longer than that?
Most activities eventually have a rate of diminishing returns. So when we think about physical activity recommendations for adults, the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S. recommends that adults get about 150 minutes of activity per week. So if you divide that by seven, that's about 30 minutes of brisk activity per day. So if you are someone who has a little bit more time on your hands, it's just fine to do a little more than 30 minutes. 30 minutes is typically the amount of time that is used in the research studies. If you have time to walk for 40 minutes or more, all you're going to do is get more benefits. But I would not recommend that you're doing interval walking longer than an hour. There's a potential with that change of pace to end up with some musculoskeletal issues, like you could have an Achilles tendinopathy or shin splints or start to have pain in your arch or something like that if your body isn't well conditioned for it. And so my recommendation is sticking 30 to 45 minutes and then doing other things if you want to do other activity. You could cycle, you could swim, you could dance, you could do all kinds of other things to continue to get those cardiovascular benefits. Our bodies like variability. And so this should be a component of a program, not just the program.
Now, when people see a trend like this and think, I'm going to do this, should they just go straight out and do it? Or do they need to build themselves up, maybe do 15 minutes and then 30? And should they warm up beforehand?
Yes, I always recommend both a warm-up and a cool-down. As I said, I'm a physiotherapist, and so that is one of the things that we deeply believe inside of our souls, is that you want to prepare your body for the activity, and then you want to sort of give your body a chance to come back to homeostasis after you've exercised. If you're somebody who has had a significant break or time away from being active, 10 to 15 minutes is probably a great starting point. You want to make sure that you're not creating any musculoskeletal discomfort. You want to make sure that you are finding safe routes so you can feel confident that you'll be able to do it without any sort of issues. There's some neurocognitive demand as well with these types of activities. And so we want to really start slow. So I would recommend, if you're someone who's not particularly active at the moment, a 10 to 15 minute full session is plenty. 3 to 4 minutes of warm-up, 5 to 10 minutes of Japanese walking, 3 to 4 minutes of cool down. Now, if you're somebody who is already active, you're used to walking 20, 30 minutes a day, an hour a day, you're playing pickleball, maybe you're hiking, you know, playing with your grandkids, swimming, all those sorts of things, those are the folks who can probably jump right into that 30 minutes. I would, however, also caution them, you absolutely want to take a rest day the day after this type of activity. Give your tissue a chance to recover. See how you feel. Gauge if you start to feel any aches and pains or discomfort. If you do, take another rest day and come back to the activity after 2 days of rest. Generally speaking, most people could do this if they don't have any comorbidities or other issues most days of the week, but you want to start slow so you don't end up in the physiotherapist or chiropractor's office.
Yeah, good point. How important is good footwear?
I would say it is my number one recommendation, and I have three criteria which makes a good shoe. The first is that the shoe should have a wide toe box. That doesn't mean that it's a size wide shoe. A size wide shoe is related to your foot volume. A shoe that has a wide toe box allows something that we call toe splay. And what that means is that instead of your toes being pinched together and crowded and touching, they're able to have open space between them when you're wearing the shoe. The way to tell if a shoe has a wide toe box is flipping it over and looking at it and saying, does it look like my foot? And we can definitely say that a lot of women's and men's dress shoes that have pointy toes, they do not look like a foot when you flip them over, right? They look like something that is a bit of a medieval torture device. But we want to pick a foot-shaped shoe. The second criteria is that the shoe is twistable. So if you take your walking or running shoe and you're able to twist it, almost like you're wringing out a towel that has water in it, that's an important criteria as well, because it means that the shoe is not limiting your normal foot biomechanics. If the foot is limited from going through its normal range of motion, guess what happens? A chain reaction up your biomechanical chain. If we're limiting your foot motion, guess where the motion has to come from? Your ankle or your knee. And so when we see individuals who are wearing shoes that are too supportive or too restrictive, a lot of times they're the individuals who complain of ankle, knee, or hip pain. The third is, and I think this one is very surprising, less cushion is more. So shoes are currently over-engineered, and they have huge pillows of cushions and giant stacks under the heel and all this like foam and pillow. And what's interesting about that technology trend in footwear over the last 15 years is that it diminishes your ability to feel the surface you're walking on. It also causes some instability. If you are to step on an uneven terrain, an angle, a rock, a stump, you're going to feel squish rather than feeling what you're stepping on. And so my three criteria are wide toe box, that it's flexible, and that it has minimal to low cushion. And I think that surprises a lot of people when we make that recommendation.
Yeah, I just learned something. I've got about four different pairs of hiking shoes, and they only meet two of those criteria because they're definitely not flexible at all. And gotcha. I find if I go for long hikes, the ones that are really flexible, they don't meet number one or they meet one and two, but not three. You end up with tired and with muscular shoes if you don't meet any of those three. So that makes perfect sense.
When your shoe is rigid, the little intrinsic muscles, which are the tiny muscles between the bones in your feet, don't have to do their job. And so what happens is the shoe is doing the work for you. And so your feet actually get more deconditioned. The tiny little stabilizing muscles over time will actually get weaker. There's phenomenal research out of the US. Irene Davis is an incredible researcher, and she's done a lot of work related to how footwear impacts foot strength. The other important thing to note, and people are very, very surprised by this, there's a famous research study in the States as well that says over 60% of adults are wearing the wrong size shoe. And that means length. So like for European, a 40 versus a 42 versus a 43. For the US, a size 9, 9.5, et cetera. Adult feet change size. And it is so important to have your foot measured by a professional yearly. Most people think, I'm an adult, I'm done growing, my feet aren't going to grow. But feet change size for various reasons. Muscle gain or loss, different medications, swelling, bony changes. There's all sorts of reasons. And so it's always surprising when I tell individuals that it's important to get your foot measured every year by a professional at a shoe store.
I'm also a freak insofar as my shoe sizes are about 3/4 of a size different from my left and right.
Yeah, that's very common. Very common. You're not a freak. That's very common. And okay. So when that happens, what we typically recommend is buying to the larger size, obviously, and then trying to take up some of that space in the smaller foot with a thicker sock.
I'm learning a lot here. It's good stuff. And I've been walking all my life. So are there other things that people need to take into consideration? I mean, there are different climates, warm, wet, food intake. Should people wait until they get back for food? Should they take food and drink and have that on the way?
From a sports nutrition standpoint, you typically don't need to take on any calories unless you're working out for 45 to 60 minutes. So generally speaking, you shouldn't need to eat or take in, you know, sports nutrition for a 30 to 45 minute walk. We definitely recommend hydration, and the best science currently says that if you're going to bring along a water bottle or something along those lines, for proper stomach emptying, you want to take about 4 ounces at a time. And so if you have a 16-ounce water bottle, you could think of that as like 4 big drinks. That's a good way to keep your stomach, prevent it from getting upset. It's a good way to keep your tissues hydrated. Our joints need fluid in the body for lubrication. And so you can kind of think of that as putting some oil in the Tin Man to make sure that you're well hydrated from a cellular level and a joint level while you're doing the activity.
And what would you say about temperatures? I know that everywhere it seems that because of climate change, temperatures seem to be on the rise. Is it a case of if it's warm or hot outside, people should not bother, or should they just say, well, I'm going to go out anyway and put on a hat and hydrate?
I mean, I tend to think it really depends on the person's tolerance to hotter environments. Some people actually like to go out and work in the middle of the day because they enjoy that feeling of sweat and their body and their tissues feeling quite warm, and others don't tolerate it quite as well. So for me, I tend to recommend the older you are or the less frequent you've been exercising over the last few years, the cooler temperature I'd like you to start in. You know, if you're an avid exerciser and you're someone who's used to being in warmer environments, I generally think it can kind of sort of be dealer's choice or that person's own discretion. But for my patients, if you are, you know, over 50, over 60, or someone who's returning to physical activity after a layoff, those are the individuals where you want to control the controllables. And by walking early in the morning or later in the evening, you're just minimizing the stress of the temperature change while your body is adapting to the physical activity. So we're trying just to like minimize how many things you're adapting to at once.
It seems like the Japanese walking or the interval walking is pretty decent. Are there any trends that you look at or videos that you see on social media and just look and go, no, no, no?
Well, there is one that feels a little vulgar that you see in the States, which is an after dinner walk. And it's positioned for gut health, but it's called a fart walk, which I think is just sort of trying to be edgy or something. But the purpose behind it is really talking about, you know, blood sugar management after a large meal, helping with GI progression for people to, you know, use whatever they've eaten. I kind of think that that one is, the science makes sense of going for a walk after dinner, but the way it's been positioned in social media, it feels to me a little silly. So I just, again, as I said earlier, I'm all about advocating any movement is better than no movement, right? The amount of sitting that people are doing nowadays has really become such a negative health impact that over the last several years, there's been sort of this theme within the healthcare industry saying sitting is the new smoking. And we can all agree that smoking is not good for us. And we're now starting to say that sitting has as significant of health impacts, current wellness, health, and future longevity as smoking. And I think that that stops people in their tracks a lot of times, especially if you do work in a seated profession. Do you have a standing desk? Can you take breaks? Can you go on micro walks throughout the day? There's really wonderful data that says as long as you're walking greater than 2,500 steps a day, if you increase that by 500 steps, which is about a 5-minute micro walk, you can reduce your risk of death by 7%. If you're at that baseline of 2,500 and you increase by 1,000, so up to 3,500, it reduces your risk of death by 15%. Those are statistics from gigantic multi-year, multi-center research studies, the kind of science that really, really, really matters. Hundreds of thousands of subjects data goes into those statistical reports. And so I think that, you know, for me, it's very much about impressing upon people little actions can add up to significant impacts, health, wellness, longevity. And that's really all what everybody's looking for, right? Is we want to live a long years in good health. And walking is absolutely a keystone there. And so for me, it's one of those things where if it's Japanese walking or it's interval walking or it's, you know, all these different, there was a trend a couple of years on social media ago called Hot Girl Walk. And everyone was going for walks in the summer and posting it on Instagram. And it was very, very popular sort of in the millennial age group. I was all about it. I'm like, this is great. We've got a different population of people enjoying and encouraging others to walk and modeling that behavior and cheering each other on. So I just really believe that this is one of our most underutilized and just sort of taken for granted health interventions that most people have at their fingertips. You could start this today. You could go for a 5-minute walk right now. Pause this podcast. Go for a walk. Come back. Guess what? You're going to feel better. You're going to be putting some coins in that bank for your future health. And so that's really what our platform is about, is just trying to encourage people to understand the science, believe it, and then implement it in their daily lives.
Wow, some great information there. Is there anything else that you wanted to add to that?
Yes, I want to myth bust something. So here's a myth bust for everyone who's listening. For those of you who think that 10,000 steps a day is the number of steps you should be taking, please hear it from me and many other sources that that is incorrect information. So the 10,000 steps a day idea came from a marketing campaign in the 1960s in advance of the Olympics. And it was never based on science. And it has been refuted by research study after research study after research study for the last 50 years. However, that message really has stuck in the general conventional wisdom. People think, oh, if you ask a man on the street, how many steps do you need to take per day to be healthy? They'll say 10,000. And it's incredible that that has persisted over the years. So I want everyone who's listening to the podcast to know this. The absolute basement of steps per day that you should take in order to get health benefits is 2,500. So if you are incredibly sedentary, you've got some limitations, you're struggling with pain, with other diagnoses, other disorders, maybe you live somewhere that walking outdoors isn't safe, 2,500 is your absolute, absolute, absolute basement goal. So if you can get to 2,500, as soon as you get to that level, doing a little bit more, a little bit more, the health benefits start. There are phenomenal health benefits related to the risks of having depression symptoms and having worsening depression between about 5,000 and 7,000. For general health and longevity, if you're under 60 years old, the target number, science-based, is 8,500, not 10,000. And if you are over 60 years old, the target is 7,500, again, not 10,000. So to review those, there's benefit at 2,500. As you go up into the 3,000s, we start to see some dementia prevention. In the 5,000s, we start to see depression prevention. And then for general humans who are pretty well healthy to start, if you're under 60, it's 8,500. If you're over 60, it's 7,500. Another important caveat with all of those numbers is micro walks count. Little accumulations of steps throughout the day count. So do not feel like you have to go and knock out 8,500 steps. It's going to take me 45 minutes. I don't have that kind of time. As long as you're walking above 2,500, little 500 to 1,000 step bites throughout the day, add into that bucket. And so that is a really big part of our platform, is we are working really hard with Gait Happens and then with the book that we have coming out next year to dispel that 10,000 step myth. So if you take away nothing else from this conversation today, my friends, 60% of adults are wearing the wrong size shoe. There are three criteria for shoes that I believe set you up for health, which is a wide toe box, a thin and flexible sole, and the shoe being flexible and twistable. And then 10,000 steps is a myth.
I don't know if I should be embarrassed, but so many things I didn't know. I guess next week I'm trying to find a new pair of hiking shoes and getting my feet measured if I can find somewhere with a big enough Brannock device. I believe that's what those measuring things are called. Who says our podcast isn't educational? I was actually going to do one of my occasional rants, but with two interviews like that that are both long and excellent, it puts you in a good mood and makes me want to go out walking, so I'll save the rant perhaps until next week. I already recorded it because I was annoyed. Usually I go back to it later and think, oh, I better tone it down, but this time I didn't. Not sure if I'll be out walking this weekend or not, in my shoes that don't meet Melissa's three criteria, but as Meatloaf said, two out of three ain't bad. Who knew that he did a song about hiking shoes? Regardless of whether or not it's a hiking weekend, I will prepare just in case, and that means charging the charger, the phones, the cameras, the microphones, the drone, and who knows what else. Myself, probably. I guess now we've passed the solstice, so it should start getting a little darker at night. We're very close to a dark zone here in the UNESCO biosphere, which I think just means that we have a much bigger village sign to fit that in, and the place names in both English and Gaelic. All right, well, that's it for another podcast. Interviews, amazingly, are done for next week already, which may never, ever happen again. If you have news or suggestions for podcast guests, please do get in touch through jim@walkingpost.com. So, I hope you enjoyed this week's walkingpost.com podcast, and I hope you'll have a great week, hopefully with a walk in your perfect shoes. So, until next time, happy trails! Walking Post from walkingpost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.